This is an interview with Betty Schmidt, a graduate student in the French department. The interview is being conducted on June 11th, 1976. Laura Smail is the interviewer, and the subject is the TA strike of 1970. On June 11th, 1976, Laura Smail is the interviewer. The subject is largely the TA strike of 1970. Yes. Well, tell me about yourself to begin with, would you? Where you were born?
I was born in New Jersey, lived there until the age of 12, at which time we moved to North Carolina because my father, who was a mechanic, decided he was going to become a philosopher and was going back to school. So we went to University of North Carolina and from there to South Carolina. My father's first teaching position was at Converse College, Spartanburg, South Carolina, where I went as an undergraduate.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And I was a modern language major, had a Fulbright grant, went to France after I graduated. There I met a woman who was in the French department here at the University of Wisconsin, and she's the one that talked me into applying. And I received—
Who was that?
Susan Saverin, who is now teaching in Los Angeles. Has finished her degree and is working out there. So I was— my first year I was on a fellowship here, and that was 68-69 when I came. My Fulbright year was 67-68. The second year I went on to became a TA. Now that was prior to the contract status.
In September of 69?
Yes, September of 69, I was a TA, and it was a one-year basis back at that time. It's still, you didn't get a four-year contract, it was before. And I remember I didn't know too much about the TAA at that time. My first year here, I was not involved very much with the other teaching assistants because I was a fellow and I, you know, stayed most of the time in the library. I didn't discover I had an office until second semester. And
were you active in any of the campus?
No, I just remember, you know, hearing about, you know, the Dow things, and I remember also the Black Studies thing, and sort of being sort of concerned, but not— I was just very busy studying all the time, and I wasn't active in anything. I had never been active in any of the war, the anti-war demonstrations or anything.
Was this just because you weren't thinking, or were you—
I think it was because of the conservative background, having grown up in the South.
So you weren't particularly sympathetic with the—
No, I wasn't sympathetic at all. I just didn't think about it. I was sort of apolitical at the time. I, you know, just worried about my education. Yeah. It was, you know, even apathetic. And the French department turned out to be quite active. I remember my roommate was the steward. I wound up rooming with this woman. We found out later that she was in the TAA, but it didn't really occur to me. I guess I sort of joined. I did join because I thought it was, you know, I didn't make a distinction between TAA and graduate students, any kind of an organization at the time. And then things started—
Wait a second now. This was— when you joined the TA, you still didn't think of TA as being particularly—
I didn't think of it as a radical organization or anything, which a lot of TAs did later. Yeah. They were concerned about joining the TAA because it didn't fit in with their image of what a graduate student should be, and it seemed like a very radical organization to them. When I first joined,
and when was that?
That must have been that year, 69-70.
But I mean, you became a TA in September. Do you remember?
I don't remember. I think I just joined because my roommate was a member. The other two that went through was two people, actually. They were both members. And it was just one of those things that seemed the proper thing to do at the time and didn't concern me that I never went to meetings or anything.
Oh, I see. Do you remember how you joined? I mean,
it was just
the process?
A card. There was a card to sign.
And you had to pay?
And dues were going to be taken out of my—
Do you remember how much they were?
They were $1.40. I think it wasn't anything.
That's not
per month.
Much,
I believe, you know, I wouldn't— well, I'm not really sure because they've changed so much, but it wasn't
like
very
that.
Much.
Yeah.
It was to come out of your salary each month. It was a, you know, check-off, payroll check-off.
Now tell me again the name of your roommate.
My roommate is Joanne Oliver.
Oliver.
Oliver, yeah. Uh-huh. She was the steward for the French department.
Mm-hmm.
And another roommate was Pamela Weir, and we all wound up being picket captains.
Pamela
Weir, W-E-I-R. Uh-huh. She's in Australia now, so we'll be able to talk to her.
How many TAs were there in the French department?
There were quite a few back then. I think there were about 80. Now, I don't— as I say, I wasn't the steward, and I don't know how many of them were members of the TAA, but there were quite a few of us. We were a large department.
Did you meet as TAs? In the French TAs at all?
Not really, no. Not until things started moving with the strike that Joanne was trying to organize. Mm-hmm. And we were having meetings. And I remember at one point, which was much, I'm not going to be very clear about the chronology. I haven't been able to go home to look up. I don't even think I have anything.
Well, but. I could fill you in on that.
No.
But I just, one reason I asked when you joined was that there was a membership drive in October, November, mm-hmm. I guess, so that the Cardinal on November 4th mm-hmm. announced that the TA membership had suddenly increased to 1,000 from something like mm-hmm. 60. And I wondered if you were aware of that drive.
It seems like I was probably because of that, because it had not occurred to me to join of my own, I don't want to say free will, but it's not something I did at the beginning of the year when I became. Yeah. But it seems that it was in connection with a membership drive. It was in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it must have been Joanne said it was important to join at this time. So I was very docile and did what she thought.
But you still weren't interested getting your rights as a TA.
Well, I think it was important to me that I was assured that this was not anything connected with a radical, with any kind of radical movement.
Now, how did you convince yourself that it wasn't?
Well, Joanne was talking about, it was put in, they were very good with organizing with people like me. It was put in the context of the whole labor history of the United States, and that this was, something that was very, American in a way. It was just a labor issue, and it wasn't connected to any of the anti-war things or anything else. Uh-huh. And I was, people just, there were so many so-called horror stories back in those days of things happening to TA's cases that, were cited to us.
Thrown out.
Yeah, that raised your indignation. And you started, I think one of the strongest points was that I know within our own department, at the end of each year, it seemed unfair that the people were cut off. The TAs were the ones that were doing the work. They didn't have as much time to devote to their own studies because they were teaching. Mm-hmm. They sometimes had lower grades, and therefore when cutbacks were made, they were the ones that were booted out, and people that had been on fellowship were then given the support, the TA contracts.
Yes, that would be because
those sort of things, the idea that we had a right to a contract, we had a right to a grievance procedure, and all sorts of things that I had never thought about. When you seem so thankful when you come in as a graduate student, have any sort of support at all. It was hard. It was an identity change, thinking of yourself as a worker rather than as a student, sort of submissive to the faculty and doing what they said. And it was a gradual process for me, I think, too. But I just got indignant at some of the things that were happening.
Did you talk to faculty at all about the TA, or did you have any, were you friendly with members of the faculty?
Not at that point, I wasn't. I went to my classes. That was still before I had decided what I was going to, what my specialty was going to be. I had an advisor, but he just, consulted with me twice a year, and I had no friends on the faculty.
Really?
I was very intimidated by it. Courses are all in French, of course, in the French department, and it sets up this sort of barrier that was hard to break down. Some people were friendly with the junior faculty. Mm-hmm. But this, as I say, it was my first year. And I think that came from being TAs more than from being a graduate student, because they were there working more. As I say, my first year I was very isolated. I just went to my classes and came home. And this is the beginning of my second year, and I still hadn't had much contact with the faculty, mm-hmm. other than the few people I had in class. And I was very intimidated by them, so I didn't go see them for other reasons than just classwork. And there was an uncomfortable situation in the department. There were a lot of departmental politics at the time, and fighting.
What about, do you remember?
I just remember, Richard Switzer was the chairman at the time, and he subsequently resigned in connection with something that happened with the TAA strike. The faculty had decided at a faculty meeting right after we went out on strike that they were not going to, for the duration of the strike, they would not furnish information to the administration of their own accord, they were going to remain neutral, which meant they weren't going to go around and find out who was teaching. Later, they would assist when the strike was over. They would, you know, provide the information that was needed. But they, and apparently, Mr. Switzer had cooperated with the dean. This is hearsay, behind the backs of the faculty, and he. But even prior to that time, I think there was a lot of animosity between the way he, you know, treated the faculty and his relationship with the deans. That was my impression. Yeah. I just knew that there were problems, and there were sort of different factions in the department. I was sort of wary of, you know, getting too involved with or signing with anyone at that point.
How many classes did you have?
I had three each semester.
Does that mean, in how many sessions?
Oh, you mean as a TA?
As a TA, yes.
I was a graduate student. At that time, I was teaching. That was another thing. I was teaching two separate courses, and I was TAing for a professor where I met twice a week with sort of like a quiz section, and the other one I had full control of. It met five times a week, so I had seven contact hours. I was in the classrooms. No, it was four. That's right, four. Four and two. 6 hours a week. Mm-hmm. I was in the classroom. Now I had two preparations because I was teaching two different courses. I was getting paid less than my roommate who taught two sections of the same thing and with only one preparation. Yeah. And that's another thing that started bothering me, that there wasn't really equity in the way we were being paid. Mm-hmm. I was being paid on because less because I was teaching 4 hours of first year, which paid less, and she was teaching two sections of second year. So there was a lot of, you know, inequity in the appointments in the French department at that time, which now have been ironed out. Hmm. But throughout the strike, I think without that, it would be.
Throughout the strike, you were teaching the whole time, were you?
No. I think I was beginning to say something about the. Seems like I was going to say something about the support of the faculty for the. I think we had a unique situation in the French department because we were one of the strongest departments, and there was a great deal of solidarity among the teaching assistants. By the time the strike began, nearly about two-thirds of the TAs were going out on strike, everyone that was a member of the union.
So that gives us an idea of how many.
And I think we were one of the pivot departments. In a way, because we were a large department and we were, as I said, very strong internally. We supported each other, you know, and pulled a lot of people together. And we also felt that we had the support of the faculty and there weren't going to be reprisals. And I think that within our department, and that helped
that
a lot.
Made quite a difference.
Because the university was talking about firings. And the interesting thing about that is, too, it was the first time in my life that I really evaluated things and decided that something was more important than my education here, and that was my rights.
Yes, that
my
was
rights.
That.
And I was willing to forfeit all that for the cause of the strike. And they could talk to me. Once I was out on strike, the university could say anything, and I wasn't going to take threats. You know, it was a way of standing up and not being intimidated by the system, and that.
And you really believed you might be fired and you might be thrown out of college. I mean, I suppose many TAs didn't really believe that they or weren't really worried.
I thought about it, but as I say, it had a lot to do with friendship and solidarity and feeling that you were in the right. And the things that the university started doing just sort of, you know, made us feel we were right. You know? And I was worried about not being able to go back, but I sort of accepted that. I figured I'll just have to pick up the pieces. If I can't, you know, come back here, I'll have to go somewhere else. But everybody else was too. So.
Yeah. Now, do you think this was because of somebody, one of the TAs in the French department who was responsible for making it evident to you, all of you, what a good case you had?
I think that was
part
of it, but I think it was also the leadership of the union. I remember when I started going to the meetings, I remember being extremely impressed with what was being said. Jim Marchetti, Bob Muhlenkamp, they were all extremely good speakers, extremely convincing, and I believed it. I believed what they said. I told my roommate, you know, Bob Muhlenkamp said I should jump off the top of Van Hise for the cause of the strike. I probably would have done it at that point because he had a certain charisma that inspired you, and you felt as I said, they were extremely intelligent men. I say men because I have a recollection that we were being led by men at that point. And
yes.
This will probably come out later to my recollections of what the women were doing. But
do you remember when you started going to meetings?
As soon as I realized that it was quite possible that we were going out on strike, and
then
we had general membership meetings.
February.
It was second semester, because as I said, I'd always been such a serious graduate student. I mean, in a way, I'd gone overboard on my graduate studies, and I didn't go to very many meetings of any kind. Either when I wasn't teaching, I was busy studying, and I believe it was second semester that, as I say, my chronology is weak, I don't remember.
Well, the strike vote was March 3rd.
Mm-hmm.
Did you start going before then?
I think it's at probably the beginning of second semester when I started going.
The negotiations came to a halt in January,
mm-hmm.
and there were about two months there was no negotiating going on. And there were meetings then. Frequently, once a week or a month?
Well, see, my roommate Joanne would go to the Stewards Council on Sunday nights, and I would usually get reports through her of what was going on. I don't remember specifically, but she would talk to me when she'd come back. And so I sort of would keep up with what was going on. And I don't really remember how many general members. I remember doing a lot. I was even started trying to recruit people within the French department, which was really a new role for me, convince other people. And I think they considered me a good person to be talking to other people, because
yes.
I had been very, people thought of me as very conservative.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember that. And whereas Joanne had been, dubbed as a radical, and people were sort of put off by her. And
did you succeed in persuading people to join?
I think so, yes. I can remember it was just a matter of, people sort of being very upset, and we were arguing with each other all the time. We were still very close, even if people were still on the other side and didn't want to go out and strike. People were concerned about their students. That seemed to be the most common argument. I owe myself to my students. I can't walk out on my students if there's a strike. Other people thought that it was just not dignified and didn't fit into we should be using reason. We shouldn't be using force as a means to deal with the university, and we owe them a lot and this sort of thing. And sort of developed techniques for arguing, which sort of interesting. But little by little, we picked up support, and I can remember being very excited when a good friend would decide that it was time to join the union and consider going out on strike, and it fortified all of our resolve that this was the right thing
Positive
to do.
Positive feedback.
Yeah, right.
Where were the meetings?
Usually just the departmental meetings were when the TA offices, within our department.
The whole TA meetings.
In various buildings on campus, it varied, which, B10 Commerce, a couple times we met in Ag Hall. The same thing during the strike when we were having meetings, it would just be, different different rooms. There was a great deal of paranoia. I remember we'd always worried about, people from the university listening in. I had this feeling we were changing. I think that was just, if they wanted to infiltrate, they certainly could have. It was silly to worry about the room that we were in.
That's why you changed. You thought.
That's why we were changing rooms, because they were afraid that.
It does seem improbable that they wouldn't find out.
I don't know. That was just something that people used to talk about. Listening in, the university listening in.
Yeah.
I don't know whether, as I say, they certainly could have sent someone in to listen to the meetings. Although we were checked at the door, we had to show our cards.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. Well, now I understood that you didn't, people didn't have to be TAs to
be a member of the union. You could be a resource assistant or a project assistant.
But you had to be
on
one
payroll.
Of those. I see.
You had to be on the payroll.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't just be a graduate student to be a member.
Hmm.
That was my understanding. I believe you could be a member for a semester after you had been a TA, but not just a graduate student.
How many people, when you started going to meetings, do you remember about how many were there?
It's very difficult to remember. I get them all confused now in my head, whether they were during the strike or prior to the strike. I know when it was time for serious decisions, I remember being in B10 Commerce and the place was packed. That was the night before we went out on strike. It must have been, 600-700 people in the room. But prior to that time, I don't think, there might have been about 250 at it. As the momentum increased, more people were coming, more people were concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And
Now, this interests me that you speak of Muhlenkopf and Marchetti as being good speakers and persuasive. They were thought of by the faculty as extremely radical, especially Marchetti. Mm-hmm. And you said yourself that you and others were concerned that you didn't want to be swept into a radical movement. Did you cease worrying about being in a radical movement, or did you not think that their radicalism was important here?
When we were having our meetings, we were talking about the issues at hand mm-hmm. and the TAA and the university, and we weren't talking about other things that might have concerned me. Mm-hmm. I didn't think of them. I stopped thinking about that. I think it was just the people I was involved with, the fact that my friends were there with me, that there were a great many TAs from all over the university that were involved in this thing, mm-hmm. and I stopped thinking about what kind mm-hmm. of a movement. I can remember the first few days out picketing, I got sort of concerned because Mother Jones was marching around with signs and pamphlets about the TAA and World Revolution. And I started wondering what I had gotten myself involved in. But I do remember, and there seemed to be, you know, an effort on the part of the leadership to put it in the context of the labor history of the United States, mm-hmm. and that this was a labor dispute,
yeah.
which it was. And not to go beyond that context. I was starting to say, I remember towards the, when we came back from spring vacation, we had a meeting to decide whether to step up tactics and whether we had very conventional picket lines. They just marched around. Mm-hmm. We hadn't tried to forcibly keep anyone out of buildings. We tried to be militant just by being loud and having a lot of us there, but not, and to talk to people, but there hadn't been any violence. And we were talking about whether to increase tactics. And that concerned the French department in particular. We were very concerned about that.
You didn't want to.
No, I mean, putting it in any kind of destruction of property or anything like that. Some of these things probably aren't the kind of things you should talk about on tape, but things were,
this is history. This isn't going to be broadcast.
No, I know, but it was certain things were mentioned that could be done, and in fact, forcibly trying to keep people out of buildings, and there was a split at that time.
Well, that's, I knew that, and I would wondered if you were aware of it,
Well, I remember that. I remember, too, we were in Ag Hall at that point. There's a balcony in that, and it's an older building, and I remember there were people that were talking, in a way, I think it was the Radical Caucus that was pushing, stepping up tactics and suggesting that things could start happening around on campus, and this would be one way of, forcing the university to, bargain more seriously. And I remember at that point that the French department was very concerned, and Joanne took sort of, we caucused and decided mm-hmm. that we would not support this sort of a thing. In a way, it was sort of, we were still talking and arguing this point out, and it was perhaps premature, but I remember Joanne stood up and announced that if the TAA voted as a group to step up tactics, that the French department would no longer support the strike. And that was, in a way, I think she was blackballed for a period of time because it was thought that this was not the proper thing to do at that time, and the leadership was sort of shunned her for
really?
A period of time.
You were the only department that expressed yourselves on
well,
this?
Well, as I say, it was very early in this discussion, and mm-hmm. it was the sort of thing that, it was one of the first times that we realized that we had this division, this mm-hmm. really strong division.
It actually solidified it by
it solidified it, there was a silence, and people realized without the French department, one of the major yeah. departments supporting the strike, a solid department where everyone was sticking together, that the whole thing was going to collapse. And
But in fact,
that
it
was
might
a
have
very
had
bitter,
some effect then, mm-hmm. even.
We didn't vote to, we immediately pulled together again as a group. That was one thing that was amazing about
the TAA.
The whole group, and we started, we talked it out and in effect did not vote to, I don't know, but maybe my recollection is, I don't think we would have been voting as a group on record to step up tactics because you don't want something
but
that's what we were
talking
about.
Yeah.
That's what we were talking about.
Do you remember who the people in the Radical Caucus who were speaking about this were?
I don't remember very many.
They weren't the leaders of the TAA,
no.
were they?
No.
No, I got the impression that they were sort of a...
There were just people sort of suggesting other things, as I say, that might happen. Mm-hmm. But I don't believe it was One thing that I always admired, especially in the leadership, was that they let the rank and file iron things out. They chaired the meetings and they gave their suggestions. But when things got going, and they let us work it out with minimum of direction.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think they believed that it had to be a group decision.
Mm-hmm. Now, who do you think of? You've mentioned Muhlenkamp and Marchetti. Do you mm-hmm. think of them, those two, or is there a larger group?
Well, it's one of those things where there's so many images of so many people. It's just, I think back on it, in a way, it's one of the most exciting things that happened in my life, because it was such a feeling of solidarity and community. I remember also Ira Shore, who was our parliamentarian. I don't know if anyone's spoken.
No, that's a name that I haven't come
across. Ira Shore, absolutely
fantastic. S-H-O-R-E?
Yeah, uh-huh. And who's been involved in radical politics for a long time. I believe he was in the history department, but I'm not sure, or English. But he was just a fantastic speaker, too, and he was the parliamentarian. He was very good with humor. Huh. And coming up, he would always be standing up in the middle of the meetings to clarify a point of order, and it was quite amusing. And then there was Bruce Vandervoort in history. Mm-hmm. Was also, again, all these people were such very good with words, and I remember that.
I was going to say, I wondered if the quality of the debate was higher than you might expect it to
was.
Be in that sort of.
And there were other things. There was a man, I can't remember his name, but he was a lot older than the rest of us and had come back to school. He must have been in his 50s. Mm. And he turned out to be one of the most radical people, and he was ready to throw everything away and sort of telling these young people that they had to go out on strike and they had to stand up for what they believed in. And it was these sort of people that made you believe in what you did. It's very interesting that I don't have impressions of women from the strike. I think of women speaking mm-hmm. as much as the men. And I remember you asked me on the phone if I could give you some information about what the women were doing. At the time, I remember that there was a women's caucus, and I didn't know exactly why there was a women's caucus. And I have one very vivid recollection. I think it was the same meeting that I was talking about earlier with the problem of the stepping up tactics. Joyce Telsrow, I don't know if anyone's mentioned her name,
no.
Who has subsequently died of cancer. Mm-hmm. She was in the comparative literature department, stood up. In back of me, and again was talking about the problems with the women and the structure of the leadership, and that the women had no say, so they were expected to be making the coffee and cleaning up the TA office. And I can remember thinking, why are the women always complaining? I just didn't understand. And Joanne, just sort of shrugging. And
she was not yet on that.
She topic. Was, but not. That much either for both of us. It was we started thinking about things and noticing things, and
we felt that this was interfering with the main business, which was the
I felt at the time. We have enough problems. We're trying to, and I know. I mean, I remember now, and with thinking about things, in retrospect, that what the women were complaining about was in fact that they weren't. It was the power structure that they were complaining about. They weren't in. The decision making, the higher, they weren't in the leadership. They complained a lot about democracy in the union and having a broader base.
They did.
And they also, I think there was something to do with insinuations that, I think they were talking about at one point pulling out as women if they didn't get what they wanted already at that point. And I don't know what the dialogue was, because I wasn't involved with the Women's Caucus, but I know that I was concerned that women were talking about not supporting the TAA and pulling out for their own personal gripes at that time.
Now, this was during the strike.
This was during the strike. Sort of, they could get changes in the structure of the union by not supporting the strike.
I understood that at one point the women's vote. Ed Young made an offer on the 15th of March, and it was turned down.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure this is right, but that it may have been the women who were opposed, whose vote was the thing that turned down the offer. Do you remember anything about that?
I don't remember. I, as I say, I just remember. In other words, women as a group had...
Yeah, that they may have been more radical and may have been unwilling to accept something that the rest of the group might have accepted.
At that early, we did not want that contract. When we signed, right. That couldn't have been possible because... Even this contract we took, we weren't satisfied with. Mm-hmm. The last contract vote, I remember I personally voted against it.
Oh, you did?
I was ready to stay out longer because the final contract was not what we wanted.
No,
it wasn't. March 15th, that was prior to spring vacation, I believe it must have been.
Yes, probably. It's funny, I don't know exactly, but... I think it was a little bit better than what you finally got, the thing that
perhaps,
you offered.
Perhaps, I just remember
but
that.
Nobody was prepared to accept anything mm-hmm. at that point.
No. I remember that one of the problems with the last contract vote was a lot of TAs who had, I don't know a lot, but at least a couple of people I know in the French department who had not supported the strike, had told everyone they were resigning from the union, did not resign from the union, showed up to vote for the contract in an effort to end the strike, which we thought was, you know, betrayal because they had not been out on strike and they were voting for something that they didn't have really any right to be voting for. In other words,
how many people might have done this?
I know there are three or four within the French department. I don't know whether this was a campus-wide thing, but a lot of people were voting at that point to accept the contract just to see the strike ended and had not been out on strike.
Yeah.
So there were a lot of things like that. But the day we went back, I remember was quite something. I believe it was a Friday when we went back into Van Nuys after 3 weeks, and there were the colleagues that had not gone out. The divisions remained forever, I think, until mm-hmm. people left. You know, those who had been on strike and those who hadn't, and it built a whole new community.
Yeah.
I'm in a way very happy that I had this experience because I know people all over the campus now, and I had only known people in the French department prior to this. And I think, too, that in the early stages of the strike, it was terribly exciting going to the rallies at noon and hearing that we were getting support from the Teamsters yeah. and support. The Brooklyn librarian sent us a telegram, I think, in the early stages of the strike, cheering us on and things like this.
I didn't know about that.
Things like that.
Did you get other messages like
we
that?
We did from all over the place. People, we would cheer, they would
read. Do you remember it, any of them?
And that's the one that stuck in my mind. The Brooklyn librarian sent us support. But, those are the kinds of things. I mean, they're very good at running, the leadership is very good at running the rounds, too. And Carol Riffle in our department was the one sort of in charge of the songs. I remember that too. There was a woman doing something. She was had her guitar and would move around with a little group of people and would teaching the songs and we'd sing at the rounds.
Now this is during the strike.
During the strike. Mm-hmm. And at all the meetings we'd sing our songs. And
yeah. were these songs written for the strike?
No, these were union songs.
Oh.
Out of
mm-hmm.
American history. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Solidarity Forever. Yeah. We were writing our own words for the song with Chancellor Young's name and Krinsky.
Tell me, were you aware of the faculty who were on the bargaining teams? And did you ever go to any of the sessions? I gather you could have.
Did I go to the, not during the strike, and in subsequent years I went. When there was another contract, I think it was two or three years ago, I remember going to some meetings at that time. Mm-hmm. The women were bargaining with Krinsky. The women had, there were a lot of women on the bargaining team. Mm-hmm. I think this was 3 years ago I went. But during the strike, I didn't know. I was too tired. I was too busy picketing. And I just remember hearing Krinsky's name a lot.
He wasn't, not then.
Not then. And that's my, that's because of recent years. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was Neil Buck who was one of the and Alan Christensen. Mm-hmm.
That name is familiar, but I never went to the bargaining.
But you didn't think of them as people, or didn't know them, or didn't feel one.
I just thought as the university and the bargaining team as enemies, in sort of a vague general way, but not specifically. I seem to rely very heavily on what the leadership, the bargain, the union bargaining team was telling me.
Yeah.
about the bargaining.
Well, that was Marchetti and Millikamp. What about Hasek? Wait, do you remember him?
Yes, I remember him. I remember him specifically because in the early stages, it must have been the beginning of second semester, we had a party at our house. As a part of the membership drive within the French department, and Hasek is the one that came to speak to the group. That's how I know him.
Was he a good speaker?
Not as good as the others, but also he was very good on the issues and very convincing. They were all very convincing.
And what was it that Marchetti had? You said Marchetti had charisma, or was it Muhlenkamp?
Muhlenkamp had the most, but Marchetti also. They seemed like terribly honest people. They just had a way of reporting the events and the things that were happening. I think there was a lot, I think later, a lot of us felt that when we thought about it in, you know, later years, that in a way, they were all in, a lot of them were in industrial relations. This was
Marchetti
like,
was.
Yeah, well, all right, he was. And I think there was Schramm, Carl Schramm, who was the head picket captain, and a few others that, in a way, it had been sort of a laboratory for their studies. We thought, you know, we thought about that with, I don't know, there wasn't really in bitterness, but I think a lot of it came from, a lot of the confidence came from the fact that we thought they knew what they were doing because they were, you know, they'd been studying this sort of thing.
Yeah. You weren't just innocent babes in the woods. You actually had some labor people who were,
And they've all since moved into, you know, working with unions. Not all.
Yes, Muhlenkamp left
that year. Muhlenkamp, Marchetti. I guess I've heard, I mean, what we hear is, you know, Muhlenkamp is in Baltimore with hospital workers, and Marchetti's working for the Teamsters. And this is what I have heard through, you know, people I know in Madison.
But you didn't know either of them personally?
No, I never knew any of them personally. Just as leaders of the union. Hmm.
It's a very different point of view, like. I'm just looking at some of these other names. Burress, did you know him?
Who? Somebody? Burress? No.
The two girls, Ann Gordon.
Ann
Tierney. Do you remember them?
I remember Ann Gordon.
They were head of the Women's Caucus, I guess.
I remember them, but as I say, I think this is very significant that I don't remember them as well as I remember the men. What I was thinking about and what I was noticing at the time. I didn't think women's issues were important at the time. And that's, I think, why I wasn't really listening. When it was almost like, as you said before, you know, why are they bringing this up? We have, you know, more important business to talk about.
Do you think if, with your present view of the women's position, if you were back then, you would be more sympathetic? Or
definitely, definitely. I would probably be very, very aware of power structures. I wasn't aware of power structures back then. I would have been aware of, you know, the dialogue and what was happening and within, you know, the meeting, the group dynamics a lot more than... I was aware of this sense of community and things like that, but I wasn't aware of male-female power or even, you know, a hierarchy of power coming from the leadership down. I just sort of accepted what the leadership told me and didn't worry about it that much.
Do you remember, you know, the United Faculty seems to play a rather fuzzy role in all this. Were you aware of them at all, or was anything said about them? Do you remember?
I remember being aware of them and feeling that they were sort of a radical element in the faculty and ready to support us, but not a broad-based faculty group.
I see. But you felt they were definitely sympathetic.
Sympathetic, yeah.
Well, do you know anything about the grievance committee in the TA? Did you have anything to do with that?
No, I don't remember. I don't know much about that either.
Would you want to talk about the final strike vote? Do you remember that, the night that was held? And
the final strike vote, I don't remember.
The vote to end the strike.
The vote to end the strike. It was when it was on a paper ballot, and I remember we had to go down to Brook Street, the Y, to vote, and it was a process that went on all day. I don't remember. I don't have a recollection of the final meeting. We must have voted to have a paper ballot.
That must have been rather hard to control. How did they prevent people from appearing twice?
There was a check-off when you voted. They had lists of all the TAs that were, you know, members of the TA. Yeah. It was very controlled, all the paper ballots were. But I seem to have a recollection of a meeting that, I think when we voted to have a paper ballot, it was a very depressing meeting. The meeting that I remember is the best, is the two meetings I remember, the final one with everyone, before the voting to go out on strike, yeah. That's the one, and I remember the one where we had the issue about stepping up tactics. Mm-hmm. The other ones all seem to be sort of blurred in my mind.
If you can say anything more about them. Either.
I remember the meeting in B10 Commerce. It was just packed. There were people standing up. There was just sitting all over the floor, and we had to wait for the leadership to come back with the final report from the bargaining team and what had happened. And they came in, and you know, they were very indignant about the fact the university had moved, and they had it up on this, you know, big screen so we could see what the proposals were, and they were reading them off one by one. And you had this sort of feeling that at that point we had, some people had the feeling that they were trying to withhold information and make it seem worse than it was so we would go out and strike. And I believe during that meeting there was a feeling that the leadership was misleading the rank and file because they wanted a strike.
Now when you say a feeling, you mean for instance among some of the
people stood up and said, people were challenging the leadership on certain issues and, you know, there must be other ways, it can't be this bad. And there was some sort of, you know, discussion or debate about, you know, the leadership. But, you know, that was ironed out, and we realized, I think people were really terrified that they, with the idea that now we have to go out and strike, this is the next move. It is a strike, and people, you know, you thought about it, but it was the next morning. This was a Sunday night, and the next morning you were supposed to get up and go on a picket line, and you've never done that before in your life. And, it, you know, this is when you were going to walk out of your classroom and turn your back on everything. And people were very, you know, a lot of them were very hesitant. Others were, I think there must have been a core of about, you know, 200 people that were, you know, ready to support. But the rest of us, you know, were anxious about the decision to go out on strike. And after we voted to go out on strike, I just remember this you know, silence.
You voted to go out on strike even though you were anxious about it.
Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. We just thought that there was
a
no
fairly,
other way.
What, how big a margin, do you remember?
No, that I don't remember. Mm-hmm.
Enough to be convinced.
Yeah, but I think we were convinced that we were all going out on strike, no matter what the strike vote was. That
oh,
we were
I see.
All going to support the strike. Uh-huh. I mean, there wasn't any question that, you know, only 200 of us were going to show up the next day. That, you know, there was a solidarity. You already felt the solidarity. And if we voted, you know, I knew that even if I voted no,
yes,
that I would have gone out. I voted to go out. I actually voted to go out. But I think it was a substantial. So I'm sure, you know, this is all probably in the TAA files or somewhere, it must be. Maybe you could go and look it up, but there wasn't any question that, you know, only 200 of us were going to show up the next day. That, you know, there was a solidarity. You already felt the solidarity. And if we voted, you know, I knew that even if I voted no,
yes,
that I would have gone out. I voted to go out. I actually voted to go out. But I think it was a substantial. I'm sure, you know, this is all probably in the TAA files or somewhere, it must be. Maybe you could go and look it up. But these are the kinds of things I just don't remember.
How long did the meeting last about?
Oh, it lasted very late. It must have started about 9. I don't think we got home until about 1:30. So it was very, you know, late because the bargaining team didn't come back until late. It was, and the next morning.
Well, that was Sunday night, wasn't it?
It was a Sunday night. The next morning I was a picket captain. I remember I had to be picketing at 8 a.m. or 7:45 was in front of Ag Hall. And I remember, you know, just getting up in the morning, like getting up just terrified. Not knowing what was going to. I was convinced I was going to be arrested immediately because we knew it was illegal. It was an illegal I mean, this was sort of like the first time that I'm doing something illegal.
That's right. Yeah. One forgets from this viewpoint that
right.
you wouldn't have known that these things weren't going to happen to
yeah.
you.
Well, I just, because that had been stressed that, you know, they could get an injunction. I mean, we were very well informed about all the things that could happen to us before mm-hmm. we went out. I always admired the organization. We had a little booklet as the picket captain of what to do in, you know, in different cases yeah. of what might happen. And you know.
Do you think this might have actually fired you up? I mean, it made it more exciting in a way?
I think so. I'm not, it
I mean,
seemed
if they
very
had said, actually, you're not going to come to any trouble, it's all...
I remember the thing that encouraged me was that as I was hiking over to Ag Hall, I learned that the campus buses weren't running, and that we had this seemed yeah. to me to say, okay, you're a real strike.
Yeah.
You know, the bus drivers are supporting you. It's okay. And there were a lot of people going, you know, trying to get to their offices that were very angry because their buses hadn't been there. And people from Lot 60 were walking in, and
yeah. Yeah.
all the people showed up for my picket line, and we started marching around in a circle. And everything was okay. Yeah.
Now, in Ag Hall, you probably didn't have much sympathy for people.
No, we didn't. That was we rotated around. I was at Van Hines after that.
Oh, I see.
The thing was, there weren't too many classes in there. The thing is, though, there were a lot of, you know, the clerical mm-hmm. Workers were going in, and you didn't expect support.
You weren't
because
trying
of that
to stop
point,
them, were you?
No, we were just, you know, trying to educate and mm-hmm. tell them what the strike... We asked everybody for the support, don't cross the picket line.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
I see.
And I also remembered, and this makes me think of the fact that we were trying, there was talk of trying to unite with the university workers at that point, trying to
yeah.
get their support and begin organizing, you know, and try to get sympathy and get the, you know, the I don't know, it was Local 104, whatever, I forget mm-hmm. the number, the university union to go out and support.
But they didn't.
Well, it seemed we thought it was sort of ironic to expect the people that have to, you know, clean up the floors in the TA offices and clean up after us to all of a sudden, you know, walk out. And there's been such a split between mm-hmm. the academic and the, you know, janitorial staff, and now all of a sudden we should expect them to, you know, walk mm-hmm. out and strike. You know, sort of the elitism that had always been there was all of a sudden going to dissolve. And
so you weren't surprised when they didn't.
No, but. There were a few, and we didn't get much support at Ag, but there weren't too many classes. At Van Nuys, you know, it was fun picketing because there weren't many people crossing mm-hmm. the picket lines. Of course, the people that were crossing were, in many cases, your fellow, you know, students. And I remember, too, at one meeting when we were talking about different tactics for the strike and how to convince students not to go to their classes and whether, you know, we were talking about the fact that students are not our enemy. You know, it's the TAs, the faculty, you know, the people that are teaching and the people that are trying to take over your classes are really the, you know, we're not fighting the students.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult if, you know, we started, you know, in a sense, being antagonistic toward the students because they were the ones crossing the picket lines. But a lot of the TAs had thought prior to the strike that they could continue to go to their graduate classes because it just hadn't occurred to them that, you know, they couldn't go in the building to go to their own
yeah.
classes, and that was another, you know, sort of barrier to get over, realizing not only were you not going to teach your classes, mm-hmm. you weren't going to go to any of your graduate courses.
You knew this, presumably, because you were...
Yeah,
were,
I mean, you know, but a lot of people, what do you mean? Mm-hmm. You know, it just hadn't occurred to them, and that was another thing. It just sort of, you know, horror of horrors. You know, I'm yeah. going to miss my class, and what's going to happen to my grades? And you know, but, I mean, how can you stand on a picket line and tell students not to go to their courses, and mm-hmm. then turn around and go to your own? So. That was, there were a number of things like that.
Were you aware that Nathan Feinsinger was asked to mediate eventually? You didn't, that wasn't shared among the membership?
It might have been, the name is familiar, but I don't, as I say, I think my mind has been sort of, I've gotten it mixed up with things that have happened with the TA, you know, more recently,
mm-hmm.
and the names. The name is familiar, but I didn't remember.
Well, he's in the law school and did mediate, and
mm-hmm.
Evidently the TA leadership asked him to,
mm-hmm.
Because Young wasn't talking to them,
mm-hmm.
and
I don't remember
I guess
that
he was,
being
I don't
announced.
Know how influential he was
mm-hmm.
in actually solving it,
mm-hmm.
but.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was rather an issue because I'm not sure the faculty really wanted a mediator
mm-hmm.
since Paul had worked on the TA side.
As I say, the name is familiar, yeah. but I don't connect it with the strike.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said at the beginning that this was the beginning of your awareness of the women's movement and that sort of thing. And also, evidently, you went on being a TA.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you remember how that process?
I remember. Of course, we had Cambodia right after that. Right after the TAA strike, we went back in, and then May came, and there was another cry, shut the university down again. And at that point, I realized that, you know, it was a wider issue, that other things were involved, the role of the university in the, you know, the war and things like that. And it was really, you know, I realized I had become more radical. I don't know how radical, but I wouldn't go teach my classes during Cambodia. I went to meetings on campus. I didn't follow the crowds in the streets, but I did go out into the community and talk to people about, you know, the war. Mm-hmm. So from the TAA strike, I got involved in the anti-war movement. Again, not in any violence, because I hadn't gotten that far. I hadn't gotten into the, you know, destruction of property or anything like that. But I then left for France for the summer. I had an assistantship in France the following year, so I left right after that semester.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the first thing I heard about when I got to France was Army math research. That August. And that I started reading. I started reading a lot of the, you know, basic books. I read Simone de Beauvoir, I read Kate Millett, and when I came back the following summer, I remember meeting Joanne, came to the airport, and I said, Joanne, all these things I've been thinking about, you know, they were right, you know. I think it was, I had a year to sort of think about things and do a lot of reading when I was away from this campus for a year.
It wasn't the atmosphere in France that influenced you. It was already starting. Were your parents following you along all this time?
My parents would always get concerned when they'd hear of Madison on the news. And the first thing they heard about was the Peter Pan. When I was up here, it was the Peter Pan, the nudity on stage, and that was the first thing they recalled me about while I was here. And my father is a, you know, college professor, and the way he would listen to me when I would call him about why I was going out on strike and seemed to support that. Mm. But, you know, it was for quality of education, which he's for. I never really explained all of the issues.
I could ask you how you felt about the planning issue, whether you felt that was the most important.
I thought that was important. I thought it was important.
Mm. So you were very disappointed.
I was disappointed.
And did the French department make any effort to...
We didn't have the problems that the other the departments have. We've always had... The way the structure is in the French department, we really are the teachers. There's not the same thing where you're TAing for somebody. There were a couple courses that were structured like where you were really, you know, a lackey to a professor and having to do, you know, just grading papers or doing quiz sections. But we handled the first year courses. The faculty, that was when we had a lot of graduate students, and they were teaching the upper level in the graduate courses, and were happy not to teach first year French. And this was obviously where was the best place for us to be trained and the easiest courses to teach while we were studying. We wouldn't want to teach literature because it's, you know, preparation's a lot more difficult. So we had, in a sense, control of those courses just because we were the only ones teaching in them. And there were, you know, this is not...
But you were allowed to use your own methods, which...
Well, that's not quite... There was, you know, one of the first year courses... we had pretty much, we could use our own, what we wanted to do in the classroom. There was guidelines from the faculty, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There was a faculty, you know, chair for each course, and there was a specific method being used in the first year program. But you were in the classroom with your students. The faculty still prepared the exams, and that, I guess in a way, that there were more things now that are coming to mind that bothered us at the time.
Mm.
Now things are ironed out, as I said before, but the exams were prepared by the faculty, departmental exams. And the other thing that used to bother us was we could be visited at any time without prior notice. Mm. We would have a visit that, you know, would go down on our record without...
Did you ever have them?
The beginning of the year. The chair of the course came in and sat just for
about
15
minutes.
Don't
you think that was a good idea?
I think it's an excellent idea, but since we get 24, they tell us the day before now. No, I think, and it's very constructive in the French department. Mm. The teacher training program is excellent. We have a course, and we don't have any problems that way. But even now, the TAs there are regular teachers and have that identity, you know. And as I say, plan the courses. Do we do what we want in the courses? And you really, in a way, it's sort of strange. I suppose we feel that as far as educational planning with student involvement, you want the students to tell you what they want as far as the kinds of courses they want taught, but the students aren't versed in foreign language teaching methods. And so therefore you feel that sort of input on a committee from the students is not going to be that, I mean, they have a right to be there, but on the other hand, until you've been trained in the methodology of teaching, you know, you really, it's hard to plan a course. I mean, that's sounding again like from the other side of the question.
No, I think it's quite logical.
I think we had different problems, but it was important. I thought that TAs should have, because they were so involved with undergraduate education, should have direct input and voting power on committees, within the courses they were teaching, and students too. I mean, by analogy, too should be included. And the year after the strike, there was an effort to get student involvement, but since then it's decreased. And students have not been as vocal.
So you came back all fired up, and then what happened?
Well, I was still teaching here, and I think I'm trying to think of what I had been involved in.
There was there was either one or two women in the. As who were officials of the TA in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of them is in the French department, Karen Gorder. Do you have Karen Gorder's name?
I
think that's 2 years ago that Karen... Phyllis Carr was also in the French department.
Yes, she was one of them. And I rather understood that there was that the TA declined during that period, not necessarily because they were in charge.
I have a feeling that once that very powerful, very competent leadership was gone, there was a general decline. And we didn't see, once we had the contract, I think everything changed. There was less interest again, membership dropped off. And now it's very hard to get the TAs going again because they have certain, they've always, the ones that have come in, have always had certain rights because of the contract that we didn't have when we went out on strike. Yeah. I mean, even they have a contract, they have a grievance procedure. It might not be the best, but we didn't have any of those things. Mm-hmm. And it seemed a lot more important to go out. Now, you just can't get, it seems like watching what's happened. I have not been a TA this past year, so I've just sort of followed what happened, but was not involved in it. But they just cannot seem to get the support they need plus, there, the issues just don't seem as important.
Well, things are very different now.
Yeah.
Many things.
Yeah. I mean, just, they're going out on three or four issues that seem, like they're talking about they're going to go out on strike because of, the difference between 21 or 19 in the class, or a little bit better grievance procedure, or, salary, or, and again, educational planning, but... So it's almost like when we went out, we had everything to gain, because we didn't have anything. Whereas now they have a basis. But there was a whole period, you're right, where the TA was very inactive, and I don't think the leadership was not as, I don't know what the right word is, I want to say competent, but perhaps that's the word. But I think the issues weren't there either. It was always a matter of getting a slightly better contract and moving just a little bit, but you just couldn't get the momentum. And there's been a lot of retrenchment on all. People are, more worried about their careers now.
Well, that's what I meant by saying so many things have changed. It'd be hard to get the same sort of spirit.
The war is over, too, now. And it's that's another thing. You just don't have the momentum from, of activities going on.
But you didn't become active in the TA. In those years,
no. Mm-hmm. I think at one point I had thought about the possibility of being a steward, but just didn't want to put the time into it. I believe I was asked, but I decided that I didn't want to do that.
And did you get into any women's movement of any kind?
Oh, yeah. I mean, just on I mean, I follow the things that have, I followed the whole development of the Women's Studies program here. Mm-hmm. And I was a member of the, when I, for 2 years I was a lecturer. I ran the French House. That was after my TA contract was over. Mm-hmm. I became a faculty member here. And
you ran the French House?
Yeah, I was director of the French House for 2 years. And
it's still functioning, is it?
Yes.
In spite of
it's still.
So many things have changed. It's surprising to hear that.
You talked to Germaine Mercier at one point.
Donna Taylor did.
Yeah. She, what was I going to say? So when I was member of the Association of Faculty Women, which has been involved with affirmative action, mm-hmm. Was involved in the John Roberts dispute. Just I was in her course the semester she was up for tenure. Mm-hmm. The tenure decision, followed that. Mm-hmm. Demonstrated whenever there were demonstrations. So that's the issue.
She should have been kept on.
Excuse me?
You felt she should have been kept on.
I felt that the standards were not applied equitably. That if they apply the same standards, if you're going to have an equitable, if you're going to
either apply, a lot of other people shouldn't have been
right, exactly. She should have. But I also realized that when you come right down to it, tenure decisions are based on whether the faculty feels they want to have the person as a colleague, and that's important. And I think I think that's one of the prime factors involved, and that they can rationalize keeping someone that doesn't have such a good record publishing or teaching if they really want that person, and they could not give tenure to someone who's got the best record in the world because they don't want that person.
Do you have cases you could cite for that?
Well, that's just from everything I've looked at, since Jen's thing. I sort of looked at the credentials and realized, as far as what's happened within the French department, as far as I've had the feeling that as far as the divisional committee is concerned, you have to have a certain minimum to get the person through. But if the department is strongly behind someone, they will get through, unless there's just no more room for tenured faculty, which seems to be the case right now. But I just know that when Jones' case came up, we looked at the credentials of everybody in educational policy studies, and there were a few people that had been promoted on a lot less publication. But I had the feeling with that the male faculty did not recognize the kind of research she was doing as scholarly. And specifically, she was interviewing. She had interviews with women going through changes of life, but having problems making decisions about their careers. And she was going to write. She had over 300 interviews, 350 something, and she was going to do an article on this. And they didn't recognize that as scholarly research. Interviewing women and
did she ever do it,
Well, I think that was a problem. She was, she was one of the few women working in women's studies, and she was, there were so many students that she was working with that she never really had the time to get all of her publications. She had a lot of things that were in process and, submitted for publication that had not come out in print, and that was a problem during her tenure.
Do you know what is since then she
has? Her books are coming out. Since she left here, she's gotten buckled down. I think she's felt she has to prove that, she will be a scholar.
Quite an incentive, yes.
It will help her court case, if the books do come out. But it just seemed that a lot of, for example, the book that she wrote that was is sort of the classic in the field on urban education, they didn't want to count that because it came out in paperback when she was here, but it had been published prior to coming, so that couldn't count in her favor, and things like that, which I thought were, you're looking at the person as a whole and what that person has done. It seems strange that they found a reason for disregarding everything she was doing. She had done anthologies of women writers and articles by women with introductions, but they felt that of course wasn't substantive, and that was a problem. It just seemed like everything she did there was a problem with it, although there was quite a lot of work that she had done. It's probably...
Well, I'm amazed at how long this is going on.
Vis-a-vis the university, not so much the TAA. And, you know, the daycare thing is, you know, there are things that are still called specifically women's issues, although that's, you know, they're everybody's issues.
Yeah.
So you're still, they still have the women's caucus. And, but I think that's because it's necessary because the university has not accepted the full equality of women, obviously. So, but I haven't been to meetings or anything this year. Now that I've come back and I'm a TA, I'm so tied up with my thesis that I haven't gotten involved in any activity at all.
Well, I was going to ask you, have you talked about what it's like or how it has changed being a graduate student?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, well, also about the department, the French department.
Well, everything, the French department seems so terribly relaxed to me now compared to what it was like when I first got here, when everyone was moving along at the pace set up by the university, in a sense. You know, we had the Ford track, which was, you had 4 years to get through, and you had all these very bright students who were very ambitious, and they were just, you know, plowing through. And
this is for the graduate students.
The graduate students. And now I have the feeling that everyone is just going along at their own pace. And the faculty is terribly relaxed, other than the fact that there are fewer and fewer students, and that makes people nervous. But the faculty has now dropped back down into undergraduate education and even beginning language because there's so few graduate students. But I know myself, the effect that the strike had on me was that once I had realized that I could set up my own schedule for doing things, there's something about having walked out on classes for a month and still managed to get through, I realized that I didn't have to abide by their schedule and everything was going to be all right. And I relaxed quite a bit about my own education. And it's a whole pacing. And I know people now are just, in a way, I think it's related to the job market, though. People are not in a hurry to get through because there's no reason, you know.
Was the French department on this Ford program of support for graduate students?
Yes. Now, I don't believe there's much
that
support.
Stopped
yeah,
in
it stopped. There's no money available now, but that was the big thing. You were all on or off track.
Yeah.
Depending
that,
on how long.
You had to be in order to get that money.
To get the money, right.
Mm-hmm.
Which was 4 years. It was a 4-year program, which works very fine for, I suppose, some of the sciences. And but for students that have to take a year off to go to France or even longer, that it was very difficult to get through. You know, very few people I think qualified for it.
Well, how are people getting money now?
Well, fortunately, I have no explanation for this, enrollment is up now. Undergraduate enrollment in French. I see this, you know, as a way, as a sort of return to conservatism and elitism, because maybe this is a naive way of looking at it, but French was the major language. And then when we were going through all of the war years, we sort of became aware that there were other languages, and I think Spanish picked up quite a bit because of the consciousness of, you know, the Spanish-speaking peoples here. But now all of a sudden French is way back up, and it's the old-style education, and we have just tremendous enrollment. So most of the people still in Madison are I'm on sixth-year support now because I had used up 4.5 years. And this will be, starting the sixth year of support.
Well, when you say sixth year
of
support.
That means, the contract, we're assured 4 years.
Uh-huh.
Now, the French department has a commitment beyond the contract to provide if enrollment is up a fifth year. In other words, you won't get knocked off. You know, you'll get your fifth year of support. Now, the enrollment is so high that they're hiring people that are in their sixth year. Only those that are near finishing. They're not hiring people that are around Madison. There are a lot of people that are live here. They're married here. You know, this is where they live, and they probably won't finish or not anytime soon. So they're not really committed to keeping those people on the payroll. But most of the we've had a few French students to come over who lived at the French house for a year. They were the ones that were in charge of, you know, sort of keeping up French on the halls. They're sort of like resident hall directors. And one of those has stayed on because she likes it here and she's getting a degree and she's being supported. And she's not even studying French. So that shows that there is a...
Where's the money come from?
Just the teaching assistant, the budget.
Oh, I see.
The budget, the regular budget. And I don't know how much there are a few university fellowships that we get. Money is down from... any kind of exchange. Some students, you know, there are a few positions you can apply, still apply for Fulbright program, teaching in France, but
Was that the money you had for going to France? A Fulbright?
The Fulbright was before I came to Wisconsin. Oh. I had a Fulbright. And then the second year, there was an exchange program. Because we bring two people over from France every year and guarantee them the positions in the French house, they automatically accept one of our graduate students. Mm. They'll place someone in a lycée in France for a year. So the second year I went over, that was the year after the strike, I was teaching in college in France.
In Paris?
No, I was in Clermont-Ferrand, which is in the center of France. I didn't want to go to Paris because I knew that if I went elsewhere, I'd get more of a taste of provincial French life and there'd be fewer Americans. So I don't know, I just wanted to get out of the provinces. But I'm not sure exactly how much money is fellowship and how much is TA, but I know we have a lot of TA-ships available. And fewer graduate students. I guess the contrast is that there are fewer people. That's why it seems like, I'm sure in sheer numbers of students, it's probably not as much as the heydays in the 60s. Yeah. But because there are fewer graduate students coming in, it goes around farther.
And a higher proportion therefore.
Yeah, in fact, that it was so high last semester that I had a half time, which normally they've been third time appointments, so I had a section and a half. Because they just didn't have enough people to teach. The chairman was dragging people off the street, calling up all the people that he knew in town, trying to find people to teach.
And this was all for beginning or first year,
it
second
was the
year
language,
French?
The language. I have to qualify that too and say that a lot of faculty are away for one reason or another this year too. That's the other problem. It's compounded by the fact that one of our faculty members is doing the junior year program. Alex Croft just died. Someone's just been assigned to given a grant at the Institute, things like that. Mm-hmm. So there's enough money. And I think the dean has been very generous with teaching assistants this year because he doesn't have so many faculty salaries to pay in the French department. So we're doing fine.
And you're teaching this year, you're teaching what, beginning
I'm teaching a third semester French, which is the beginning of the second year, which is a change because I'd only taught, mostly I had taught first year. But,
and you never get a chance to teach a literature course.
We used to. When I first came, those that were past prelims and were, if their enrollment was big enough, if they needed people, they would be allowed to teach a beginning literature course. Now there are some graduate students teaching assistants teaching. Well, one woman is teaching the women's course because she's the only one. Well, not the only one. One of the few qualified to do that. She's teaching in translation. French women writers in translation.
Oh.
I mean qualified in the sense that it's from a feminist perspective.
Yeah.
And so
and the
male faculty have been very hesitant to get in on the so-called women's thing in our department. That might be interesting. You could talk about that. The impact of women's studies in the French department.
Well, that's all part of your dissertation too, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, my dissertation is on, I've taken a sampling of the best histories of French literature, and I'm looking at criticism on women writers. So it's, in a sense, applying a feminist critical perspective to literary history, and criticizing it, first of all, from...
Criticizing French women writers.
No, criticizing what men have said about the French women writers.
Yeah.
Which is one aspect, sort of getting all of the negative stereotypes out of the way so you can then explore the women as they really are once you've alleviated the bias. But we have a lot of radical, very radical women feminists in the department. We're just lucky. It might have something to do with the fact that I don't know why the women are so feminist in the French department, but a great number of them.
You think
are.
They're more so than in Spanish or German?
I don't know, so I've never thought about it, but we do have quite a few. And when the women's studies thing was going through, a lot of people were involved in that and tried to immediately set up courses in the French department. And this semester we have, there are three sections of French women writers in translation. And there are two women TAs that are working in that. We have one of the faculty members is giving a poetry course just on women poets. And we've had, I guess, ever since, for the last 2 years, two women's courses every semester. And the male faculty has sort of just admitted, to the fact that women have been ignored and that we have to study them, but they have assumed that this was the job of the women, although that's not necessarily true. If you think about it, a specialist in 17th century who is a male knows the women of the 17th century as well or better as a woman who happens to be in the 20th century.
That's right.
But the problem is with perspective, and also at the point we are in women's studies, women students, mostly the students are women, are tired of hearing men talk about women. I hope this
won't
always be the
case. Most of the students are women, did you say?
Yes.
Your undergraduates or your graduates?
Not in the basic language courses, but the ones that sign up for the women's courses.
Oh, I see. It's your course.
But no, even in general numbers, the graduate students, French has always been a woman's domain. There have been men, but many more women. And that's why it always looks funny when you look at the faculty. It's all men except for a few, because it's completely reversed in the classroom situation. But the men have, and it's the same. Some of them are very supportive. Others, you think that they're sort of stepping back and sort of let the thing run its course. I don't know how long it will be before feminism has sort of operated achieved its purpose so that we can reintegrate. I'm not a separatist. I think we have to reintegrate your program. But for the time, it's like two separate studies. You do women's studies, you do men's studies, I guess, which is what we've all done. But our women's courses are full, which is nice. We're attracting, I guess what the department likes about the translation course is we attract students. It builds up the department's enrollment. It's a literature and translation, so that's nice.
So if you have so many women graduate students, and they're all, most of them, are their dissertations, do they have to do with the feminist movement? So
a lot of, again, I think it's about half and half, and it depends on the person's commitment. Those of us that, have a feminist perspective have gone into that in the thesis, but a lot of people are just doing a standard thesis, which is good too, because and in a sense, it's, I don't think anybody nowadays picks their topic in order to be shrewd as far as, for getting a job. However, I think it would be more shrewd to do old style scholarship than to do something with a feminist perspective if you're looking for a job other than in women's studies. And that's one of the things that concerns me, because I started out as a medievalist, and then I realized that being a medieval scholar entails a type of education that I ever had, a strong classical background in knowing German and Latin. Mm-hmm. If I was going to do serious research in medieval studies, and I wasn't going to go back and pick all that up. So I got out of that, and I was sort of looking around for a thesis topic, and I was going to do something with pedagogy, because I had done a lot with language teaching and training in the department, but then they didn't want to accept that. They wanted me to work in education. They're a literature-oriented department. So I turned out that they accepted this thing on women writers in histories of literature. It goes across the centuries. It's not in my specialization, but it's a topic I've had approved. But on my vita now, the work I've been doing in the last couple of years is all very explicitly feminist, and I don't know if that is affecting in one way or another my being hired or interviewed for jobs, because I know there are a lot of women that are working, but there can only be so many spots to be filled.
Especially since they probably still take at least half men in any department.
Right.
You said that you, because you were working on that kind of topic, had to have Mrs. Cassidy as your advisor.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mrs. Cassidy is, I'm not sure when we started out with this women's studies stuff in the department, it was sort of like all of the women were automatically experts in women's studies just because they were women, which was kind of crazy. It was sort of when we set up the women's studies committee in the French department, it was the women faculty, which means not very many people. But it was Mrs. Cassidy, Mrs. Cawkins was gone. I keep saying Mrs. Janet Cawkins, Elaine Cassidy. Of course, I would never call Mrs. Cassidy other than Mrs. Cassidy. But she was the one that sort of moved in to take charge.
What's her first name?
Elaine.
Okay.
And I think she was, for a very long time, she was refused a full professorship, way beyond the time. She was also kept assistant professor. I don't know what the dates are, but I know that she was one of the ones that suffered very greatly from the male-dominated faculty in the earlier, you know, before I even came. She was kept out. She was not promoted from assistant to associate for a very long time. She, you know, had a very difficult time. It was only 4 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, that she was finally promoted to full professor.
Even though you say she's already how old?
She's near retirement. She will be. She's retiring. I think she's 61 or 62. She's, you know, will probably be retiring because she's very ill right now. But it was just, as I say, it was just ludicrous. She was one example that the faculty, because they disliked her, and it was definitely related to the fact that she was a woman. They kept saying it was because of her husband, who was in the English department, you know, the nepotism thing, but I don't believe that had anything to do with it at all. But
they didn't keep him down, presumably.
No, exactly. And so she suffered a great deal, but I think when the department opened up to women's studies, I believe she saw this as an area in which she could finally operate without being challenged anymore. Yeah. She's an 18th century person, but there's also a male faculty member, Mr. Perkins, who operates in this. And this is one domain in which, you know, she can be the doyenne, as you say in French, the one that is the highest one on the...
Has she written and has she done research?
Not in women. She's mostly the research she's done has been in the 18th century. However, right now she's doing... She did do a course on 18th century women writers. It was one of the first ones that was given. But it was just in her field.
I was just wondering if that would be a reason they would have given for not promoting her, that she hadn't published.
No, but see, that came, no. She had sufficient publication. Mm-hmm. I don't know what all the reasons were, but, well, she didn't have a lot. I don't think she did write a book, I believe, but I don't know, not a great deal of publication, but compared to some of the people in the department. But now she's writing short. There's a group of women relate in the French department putting out an anthology of women writers that have never been considered, sort of to combat the exclusion from other things. And Cassidy is writing several sections for that on 18th century women. So she is technically, you know, she does work in women's studies, however, her primary specialization is 18th century. But I don't feel that she has. She's a in a sense, a feminist, in the sense that I think, I use the term feminist to mean anyone that's concerned over women's oppression. There are varying degrees of being, you know, she's sensitized to the issue. However, Mrs. Cassidy still believes very strongly. I wouldn't classify her as radical, whereas I classify myself as radical, and that she believes in a certain certain values and a certain hierarchy, which I don't accept anymore. Relating to power and authority, as far as which I see as male values
in literature or in the
literature and in university. Now, it might have something to do with the fact that she had to work so hard to get where she is as full professor. And I myself would question any kind of distinction, any kind of ranks, you know. And so that's where we're very different. And some parts of my thesis are radical. They're not just feminist, and they're the parts that we're in disagreement over.
Well, why don't you say, describe that, what the problem has been?
Well, the problem is that there's one section of she's very much in agreement when I'm quoting, I have, you know, chapters of horrendous quotes, what the men have said about the women, and it's I've presented an image of each major woman, major, that's their vocabulary again, but major woman writer, how she comes across in these histories, which is in fact the image that is given to all people learning about, all French children learning in the schools, because these are some of the texts that are used in the school system. So it's what everyone is fed in France about women writers. Now, she's very much in accordance with that, but the chapter in which I deal with the underlying assumptions, I'm using French feminist critical theory now, which is talking about the fact that Western culture, the patterns of thought in Western culture are all dualistic, and they're based on an opposition between male, female, and that there is a certain authority the critic is male. And the way you write about women, the very tone and the structures of the language you're using, sort of some of the patterns of oppression are embedded in that language. And what I'm concentrating on is showing that, which is very interesting, the French have a love affair, the French critic, literary historian, has a love affair with the 17th century and the type of literature, great classical literature, and the style and form that goes along with that, which is described as, you know, the most precise, the clearest, most rational type of writing. And they, for a very long time, especially in the beginning of the 20th century, the historians just disliked Romanticism intensely, and it was always pitted as the opposite of classicism in France. Now, when you look at the way they write about men and the way they write about women, it's the same thing. When they talk about male writing, they describe it as classical. And they talk about women's writing, it comes across as the same characteristics as Romanticism. So what I'm trying to show is that this opposition between classicism and Romanticism, which is the way all of French literary history has been written, is what is keeping women down. Because when they think classic, romantic, I mean, they don't think it consciously. It's male-female. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't want me to take the step from classic romantic to male-female. And what she has difficulty dealing with, there's a whole section in which I describe the context of the cours de littérature. There were the literature courses, which were the basis for the histories that were written later. And you have a group of men sitting at the feet of the great master. And the way I describe it, she gets put off by it because she feels it's strident, that it's very obvious that to her that I am a woman writing about these men. And she doesn't like hearing the woman's voice, which is, to me, is another point to be made, the fact that in certain types of writing, when you're writing a dissertation, you're supposed to be writing in a classical style with classical methods of research that came out of, especially in France, the same people that I'm criticizing. And anything that would be strident, that would fit in very well with the way the women are accused of writing. So that's my argument. If it sounds strident, so much the better, because it proves that there are certain ways that you're not supposed to write. Although I don't think it's strident. I think the men are strident. But it's just one section that she disagrees with.
Has she finally accepted it?
Well, she hasn't accepted it yet. I have to rewrite parts of it because, well, some of it is a little bit too repetitive. But she wants me, their whole section, she wants me just to leave out, but I don't think I'm going to. So what it will come down to is just defending it in the defense. And because she's accepted the rest of the thesis, she's not going to not take my thesis because of this one section. And my viewpoint on it now, having thought over, I think when I saw you last, I was upset because I had just seen her and she told me she wouldn't accept it. Well, the way I feel about it is my thesis, and as long as it's well written, I have a thesis. It is my thesis, and that's what as long as I prove it, and I'm consistent in my arguments and have enough to back it up, so to speak, then she can't. She can disagree, but she can't reject it because it's a thesis.
Have any of your fellow graduate students had trouble in their theses? with the what they're defending in getting acceptance from her?
Well, she's just had one recently, and she was very ill last year. She had now has no kidney. She's on dialysis 3 times a week. So last year she was in the spring she was out the entire semester. Mm-hmm. So she doesn't have anyone at the point of finishing up now. She has one student that he's a man though, and he's not anywhere near finishing, and he's in Tunis this year. But a good friend of mine, Diane Crowder, was working with her, and the problem there was, which is interesting, and I'll get this on tape, when Diane wanted to, she's working in the 20th century, but she's, again, it's a feminist perspective. Now, the person Diane felt was the most qualified to be her thesis director is Anne Cothran, who is a junior faculty member. I believe this is her third year. She's an assistant professor. The university accepts any legal faculty as a thesis advisor. Have our department just done just they've always had someone with tenure. Mm-hmm. It's just been the way they've done it. So although it's legal as far as the university is concerned, they haven't wanted to have any assistant professors directing. So they said they would not let Anne do it by herself. So the chair at the time suggested Diane find someone else. Well, the man that would have been the logical choice was Mr. Ahez, who is not very sympathetic to women's issues. And so Diane decided she didn't want to work with him, so she picked Mrs. Cassidy. Now, the problem has been that the kinds of critical approaches that Anne and Mrs. Cassidy have are diametrically opposed. And Diane has written about three of her chapters, the theoretical part. She has to fill in sections. But for each chapter, she's gotten back from each co-director an entirely different idea about what to do with it. And because Diane's ideas go along better with Anne's, she went to see Mrs. Cassidy and told her that she didn't want to work with her anymore. So now the department is admitting that Anne can, in fact, direct a thesis. Mm-hmm. Now, what is interesting about this is the fact that we have a junior male faculty member who also does not have tenure, who is directing a thesis also, and no one questioned that at the time.
Really?
But there still are things that seem unfair sometimes. So it's all taken care of, but I don't believe Mrs. Cassidy has any other... Oh, yes, there is one more... a woman that's working with her, but I don't know what her topic is. I believe it's an 18th century topic. So I'm assuming there would not be any problem.
Have you had any male reactions to your thesis yet?
For men? Did you say male reactions?
For men.
I wasn't sure I'd heard that. No, I haven't had... I've had a good friend who was a very well-known she's now a feminist critic, but she's been working in French studies for a very long time. She's not here, but she's read sections of it, and I, respect her opinion on some of the things. But what I have had as far as feedback is part of a section of the thesis I used in a paper at MLA over Christmas, and that was very well. Of course, it was, again, given to mostly female audience, but there were some men there, and I think the men that come to those things though have already thought it out, and they accept what's being said. I gave it to my father to read, who is in philosophy, and he approved. but the paper was essentially on the same thing I was talking about, the sort of the dualistic patterns, and because he deals in philosophy, he's used to this way of thinking, and he's already sort of thought himself, he's in the process also of thinking himself out of this, a sort of opposition type of thinking and into other things, so it's very interesting. But no, I haven't had any real male reaction. I don't know what male with a capital M, I think women's studies has been accepted as a domain of endeavor, at least within the French department. And even if they don't like it, they don't oppose it. They'll just sort of try to keep away from it. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of the faculty members are making an effort to use part of it and to understand it and to incorporate it. Again, and I think it's because of the lack of graduate students. I mean, you don't know what people's motives are. But I think they're much more concerned about the way students think about them now than they used to be, when there were many, many students, and they could teach anything they wanted. They could offer courses and always be assured of having students. Now they try to incorporate anything that the students are interested in. They meet the students' demands more than they used to.
It's called voting with your feet.
Right. So, but I think it's been an honest attempt on some parts to understand what's going on and see how to change their course material to incorporate women writers, and also to see what could be used from a feminist perspective. Not every, not everyone, but some of them have been very receptive.
You did say that you thought eventually this split shouldn't exist.
Well,
but do you feel at all ambiguous about it now?
Well. What do you mean?
Well, say proportionately the number of French women writers and the number of French men writers, there must be a great many more.
No, but I think you have to overemphasize in the beginning. And no one has looked at a lot of these women, so we don't know how good or how bad they are. And all of the criteria of judgment that have been used now are under question. You know, the fact of having a canon of great literature, you know, is even under question. You know, what determines taste? The selection process, you read what is available, and that's what forms taste. So, no, I don't think, you know, in fact, one of the things I said in my thesis is that, you know, no amount of, you know, revision is going to give you a 50-50 split and still represent literary history. But what I meant by that was that when feminism has sort of achieved its purpose, then we should, everyone should have, no, I think that what I meant before was that the purpose of the way we're talking now, we're exaggerating the differences again, between which is what men have always done, but we're trying to do it in a positive light. And once we have reevaluated, hopefully we can talk about men and women as men and women, but basically as people, and that we don't have to accentuate the difference because everyone will be equal. Now, I don't, you know, a lot of people believe in androgyny. By that they mean, you know, people can have human qualities now, as long as androgyny doesn't become equated with male and with that male value system, it's fine. But essentially, that's I think everything has to be reintegrated, and that you can talk about, hopefully, sometime in the future, just men and women writers, without meaning what you mean now when you say that. So,
do you get together with other graduate student, women graduate students who are also working on feminist issues on campus at all?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, we've got a regular network of.
Well, what is it?
I just mean, well, first of all, there was a criticism, a feminist criticism collective that started 4 or 5 years ago, and it was in all of the languages, you know, and it was just women interested in feminism. And now, but out of that has grown, and it has something to do with this anthology I was talking about, a certain number of women in the French department that are working on this anthology, plus there's a newsletter that's just come out now, which is being recognized across the country. It's called Bref. B-R-E-F-F, and it's a bulletin of research on French feminist studies.
Coming out of here?
Coming out of here, and it's in French.
And who's putting it out?
Christiane Macroix. She did have an appointment here for one semester. She did a seminar. Her husband is the chair of the African languages. And she's in Quebec for the semester. But because we're constantly in contact on various things, we share a lot of our work. And,
do you meet regularly?
We don't meet regularly. It's not like there's a group. It's just that...
you know who they are.
Yeah. Everyone knows whatever the work, the kind of work that everyone else is doing. And if you need to talk to somebody, you know who to go to talk to. And it's exciting in a way, you know, because there are things that are happening.
And this is just among the languages, not you don't take in history or...
No.
English, I know, take in
well,
English?
I know, for example, because of context, I mean, I know Annis Pratt very well, I know, you know, I know Fina Bathrick in film, I know a lot of the women, Evie Beck, of course, in Complet in German. I know who the sort of the women are working in women's studies in other languages, and again, if you need to talk to someone about something, you can... Plus, you know, at the MMLA and the MLA, it went to a lot of women's sectionals in all the languages and saw what was going on. So that's very interesting.
So there really isn't any organized?
No.
Any group?
Other than the fact that Bref is sort of a group because they meet to put the thing out. And the Criticism Collective, I think, stopped. It doesn't meet anymore because everyone is off in their own field right now. But I don't know what groups meet regularly at this point. Every once in a while, we were meeting last year even. If something comes up and people have a problem, they'll organize a meeting to deal with, you know. I remember last year they met a couple times.
So a personnel problem, something.
No, I mean just, it was still, the collective was still sort of around, and people, for some reason they decided to meet, they wanted to look at a specific problem. and we met and did that, which was sort of interesting. Mm-hmm. But then everyone's so busy that it's hard to read something outside and go and discuss it. And, yeah. And I think the last thing I'd want to say, which I found very interesting, I had never been to a Modern Language Association meeting before. And I went because I was giving a paper, and I thought I might have interviews, which I didn't. But I went only to the women's meetings. And I had a feeling that I was in this incredibly exciting field, that there was so much energy and vitality, and it was so much fun. But then I realized that after 2 days of going to these meetings all day and seeing practically nothing but women, which is, I don't know what the numbers are, but certainly not what the MLA is about. Yeah, yeah. I went to the president's address the first night, and it was like being thrown into a bath of ice cold water, when I realized that, in fact, from some of the ways, well, it was Northrop Frye who was addressing the convention, and some of the ways that he was talking, and they gave a prize out to a book which was described in terms of, I can't think of it, I used it in my paper because it had to do with my paper, it was the way it was described, you can tell they used something like tough-minded or solid, again, this is the ways of talking about male literature, and I realized, in fact, we had not had an impact on the main course of the MLA. We're still separate. We're doing our thing, and mm-hmm. there's a lot going on, but how are you going to get all of that? And hey, this is the structure you want to change,
yeah.
And we're not changing it. It's still it's operating, full course, and here we are over here doing our thing. I heard an incredibly dynamic speech about the woman scholar. It was called The Woman Scholar. And a black woman, who's an editor at Ramden House, gave a plea for the type of scholarship, making scholarship humane. I was thinking, why is she saying this to us? This should be delivered before, a larger group, not before the women that are there already committed.
Yeah.
And it was a nice speech, but it was the wrong audience. I mean, you can always be fed more of this, but that's the problem, is changing the mainstream. We still haven't done that.
Did you speak to any of the men faculty whom you know? About
that went in. No, I didn't. I probably should have. But
it'd be interesting to know what they think.
Yeah, yeah. See, the thing is, the ones that were there, that I saw, came to some of the women's things. The ones that were interested. I don't know how many of our faculty were actually there. I know the chairman went just because he had an interview.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not just because, but he was busy interviewing candidates the whole time, so he didn't go to very many meetings. But
yeah, it's very interesting for that the meeting.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else to say about what it's like being a woman graduate student on campus? I can't think of anything to ask you. But.
No, I think I feel very, in a sense, very secure as a woman where I am now because of the support system that is built up here, just the contacts and the women I know in French, and I don't know what it's going to be like when I move into another context.
Are you applying for a job now?
I'm applying for jobs. The market is just incredibly bad right now. In fact, I think I've only written 11 letters, which is not nearly enough. There are two more lists that are MLA job lists that are coming out, one in February and one in April. But just to give you an idea, they announced at this session that I went to, the president's session or whatever, that the job list, this booklet that goes out, there are 5,000 individual subscriptions and 2,000 departments of French, and this is all of the languages in English, subscribing to this thing, and there just aren't that many jobs listed in the thing. So you figure you've got a potential of at least 10,000 people looking at this thing, and perhaps a couple hundred jobs that are listed. Combining all of them, of course, I don't know how many are listed in English. Maybe it's slightly more, but the one job was announced. For each job that's announced, they've got between 200 and 500 applicants. So it's just, I don't know what it is that makes your name come out on top. And the thing is, I have a friend at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania who was sitting on committee and seeing someone, she says, it's just unbelievable the qualifications of the people. Yeah. Everybody is excellent.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's no, you know, unless I really think that going back to the system, you have to know somebody. Somebody that'll say, you know, look at this one in particular, mm-hmm. I know this person.
Do you feel you have any advantage from being a woman?
Not anymore, not really. Because I think they're getting away from that. I think they really are hiring the most qualified person. Mm-hmm. Women are being considered. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of hiring of women has gone on. So that they've, you know, if they're on a quota system, they've probably managed to fill their quota. I'm not sure about that, but it seems like women are getting interviews. But that, and one of the things I noticed, which seems in a way surprising, is a lot of men get letters back saying that they're excellent candidates, however, they're going to hire a woman. Now, I don't know if that's just why they're saying that, but it's created a great deal of hostility about affirmative action. I don't know that it's necessary. Yeah. I don't know exactly. I'm not too up on affirmative action. Where, you know, what's going on with that? But there's so many qualified people. It's hard to say how sex enters into the consideration these days.
Well, talk about the French House a bit.
The French House. That's one of the bleaker moments of life. No, the thing that happened with the French House, you interviewed Germaine Mercier.
Yes.
Before I came in 72, 73, there had also been graduate students running it. So prior to, 2 years prior to me, they had already sort of switched over from the image of an older French woman, mm-hmm. sort of matron, running the house and sort of representing la vieille France,
yeah. you know,
and everything in French. Plus, at the same time, the when I first came here, there were a lot of graduate students living there, mostly graduate students, very competent in French. When I took over the house, they were having trouble filling the house, and so they accepted people that weren't quite that competent in the language, and even a few that promised to take French if they were allowed to live in the house. So the initial problem that I had was trying to maintain the original function of the house.
Tell me where the house is.
Oh, the French house is over on Francis, right on the lake, not far mm-hmm. from here.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very convenient. It's a beautiful house. It's room for 30 people, mm-hmm. and there's a men's hall and a woman's hall now, which is another interesting thing. Men have only been allowed for the last, I think, 4 or 5 years. Well, it's not they haven't been allowed. It's just that there was not a demand mm-hmm. before.
Do they serve meals there?
Yes,
they do.
And mm-hmm. that's where the essential function of the house yeah. still operates. That people come from the outside to speak French, and but it was almost impossible to maintain a French atmosphere because you had some people that just could not speak in the language, and it was very frustrating for people. Plus, once they started accepting they accepted just about anyone, I think. It wasn't limited to French majors anymore. They were trying so desperately to fill up, you know, this sounds elitist in a way, but not that people shouldn't be allowed to live there if they're not French majors, but a split was created between French department people who were basically more competent in French and non-French department people. Mm-hmm. And it was a rift that I had difficulty overcoming because a lot of the people, they just didn't want to talk to the people that either couldn't speak well or didn't have the same interests, which seems strange to me because it seemed like it would add balance to the house to have people in other fields.
Unless the function of the house is to speak French,
yeah,
which I suppose it is.
And because that was the function that was constantly, that we couldn't maintain because of the level of French of, you know, half the people was not that high. Once that broke down, there was no reason for this group of people to be living together anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And it became very difficult.
So what did you, how did you handle it?
Well, we just had to keep trying. It was a struggle. There were good times that we had, it wasn't that difficult. That's just what I see as one of the things that has happened to the French house from the time of Germaine Mercier to now. It's just the fact that, in a sense now, it's a nice, it used to be a French house. It used to be a little, you know, culture island. Now what it is a very nice dorm where you also get the advantage of being able to speak French from time to time.
In other words, this Yes, there still aren't many graduates, or even fewer graduate
students. Fewer graduate
students. So you still can't fill it with French-speaking students.
No, and it's almost entirely undergraduates now, I believe. There are
really?
Few, you know, there are a few graduate students, but mostly undergraduates. Mm. And there are, you know, a lot of French majors and people that are serious about learning French, but it's I don't know if they're going to be able to maintain it. And maybe it'll change again because more people are taking French again. I think it had to do with students not wanting to put themselves in that kind of a constrained atmosphere for a while. They wanted to live in apartments. They didn't want to have any kind of rules and regulations. Not that you had rules other than having to speak French, but, you know, eating meals at a certain time every day. And
were they good meals?
Yeah, the meals compared to other dorms, I'm sure, because one of the things is, you know, they weren't... there was sort of a buffet. It used to be, another thing, you used to have sit-down meals when we had lots of money. Now we have a buffet style, but... they can eat as much as they want. It's not like, you know, it's within reason, obviously. But there's, you know, they can choose what they want, and they can usually have seconds, so they like that. And the food's been very good. The cook, the one that's there now, he was there my second year.
Do you live there now?
No. I couldn't stand the hours either, being there at a certain time, you know, for dinner, and it was very difficult. But it had its advantages, obviously. I think all it was is I just, the problem with me not being French was that, and being young, that it was hard for me to maintain, not that I wanted to, I assumed that they were adults, but they wanted someone to be in a position of authority over them. And it was confusing, they were always getting double messages, I'm sure, because on one hand I am the authority figure, on the other hand I'm their aide. Was that, and being young, that it was hard for me to maintain, not that I wanted to, I assumed that they were adults, but they wanted someone to be in a position of authority over them. And it was confusing, they were always getting double messages, I'm sure, because on the one hand, I am the authority figure, on the other hand, I'm their age, and I'm a graduate student, and I'm non-French. Mm-hmm. So trying to, whereas with, you know, someone like Mademoiselle Verdun, who was very, not that she was aloof, but she represented something, and she spoke French, and people were, you know, didn't come too close to her, and what she said was, you know, when. So I, you know, tried to set up a community, you know, incorporate them into the way the house was going to be run and took decisions to them, but, you know, especially the second year, they didn't like the idea of having to make decisions. They wanted me to make the decisions, and then they could complain about them.
You mean about who would come to speak, or?
No, just, you know, if there was a problem, you know, if we were having a problem with one thing, I would usually have a meeting after dinner and say, you know, how do you want to solve this? These are the options, or whatever, you know, whether it was a money problem or a problem with the phones. People were, you know, talking too long on the phones, and should we, you know, make a rule about this or not, that sort of thing. But, they preferred to have me just make the decision.
So it's pretty much a deteriorated
institution, isn't it? Yeah, that's the way I see it right now.
And do they still get speakers?
Oh, yeah. This French club is still active. And, well, see, now it's changed again. In fact, you might want to, if you're interested in the French house, get Michelle Maisard. She's the current director of the house. Now, she's French again, so and she has maintained a certain distance from the students. Mm-hmm. And it might be going back the other way, although there still is a problem with level of French.
Yeah.
So.